This week on Basic Black, it was more than just a handshake at the Summit of the Americas last week, as President Barack Obama greeted Cuba's President Raul Castro. It has been widely described as the beginnings of a thaw in U.S.-Latin American relations. It's been welcomed in some quarters as a mark of progress in American foreign policy, while condemned by others as a capitulation to a long-standing communist enemy. This week, Basic Black looks at the changes in U.S.-Latin American relations and what impact this could have on Latinos living in the United States, immigration reform, and economic development for Latin America. That's our conversation.
Our panel tonight: Julio Varela, Digital Media Director, Futuro Media Group; Devin Spence Benson, Assistant Professor, History and African and African American Studies, Louisiana State University; Latoya Edwards, Anchor, New England Cable News; Marcella Garcia, contributor to the editorial and opinion pages of the Boston Globe; and Peniel Joseph, professor of history, Tufts University. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
So it was the handshake seen around the world at the recent Summit of the Americas between President Barack Obama and Cuba's President Raul Castro. What does this really mean for U.S. Latin America relations? We have a great panel here, and let's just throw the question out. Who has traveled to Cuba?
Traveled to Cuba?
And so, Devin, when you saw this thing coming together and you've traveled, what did you think?
I mean, I think this was one of those moments that it's a historic moment for U.S.-Cuban relations. I think there are a lot of people who've been waiting for this for a really long time. And it was, you know, when you see it on the TV and you have the newscast coming back to back, right, with President Obama making his announcement on December 17th and Raul Castro making his announcement on December 17th, that you get the whole country looking, the nation is watching this unroll on television, mm-hmm. and we just have this sense of, wow, it's really going to happen. It's amazing. They've talked. They've had all these behind-the-scenes things. And so I think there was excitement, enthusiasm. You know, there's a part of me that's like, finally, we've been waiting for so long.
And when you traveled to the country, and had you done it recently, did you think it was it was going to happen?
No, I mean, you never know. Most of the time when I've been waiting for this, I've been traveling to Cuba since 2003.
Oh, okay.
I've taken over 20 trips to the island, led study abroad programs.
Okay.
Right, so I'm a professor, so I lead students. I go there for my own research. And for the most part, you think it's never going to thaw out. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be this complicated. Both governments are incredibly stubborn and have so many issues that weren't going to be able to happen. So I actually had a friend who was working in the White House at the time, and she called me and said, "Don't tell anybody, but in a couple hours, this announcement is coming." And I was like, "You got to be kidding!" Right? So I was a little bit prepared, but I was like, "Really? Today, December 17th? Yeah. Who would know?" So now we talk about it as the pre and the post December 17th for U.S.-Cuba relations.
Well, Julio, you're shaking your head. What do you feel?
Oh, this was just, like you said, historic in a lot of ways. Because, well, in my generation, you always knew Cuba was the enemy, right? So ever since, it's a legacy of a Cold War policy that we've had as a country that, to be honest with you, in 2015, like, how much of a threat is Cuba? Like, you have to ask yourself that question. I know for you who have traveled, and I've had tons of friends that have traveled to Cuba, and also people, friends of mine who are from Cuba that live in the Boston area, and we have this image of it being sort of backwards and dictatorial, and there's things about it that, yes, the government has issues, and it's incredibly complex. And the fact that I address this, I'm sure, you know, if someone's watching this anywhere and is probably thinking, it was like, there's so much passion. It's such a third rail issue because of the exile community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you look at the polls, like, younger Cuban Americans are believing in this.
Yeah.
They don't, there's not this romanticism of the Cuban government. We're not talking about, you know, Fidel Castro coming in New York Times in the late 50s and, you know, people like it was like the romantic revolutionary leader. There's more of a reality because there's families connecting and people are talking. And like you said, there two stubborn governments finally deciding to talk. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of, you know, conspiracy, you know, but it's happening.
Yeah. Marcella, jump in on this.
Yeah, I mean, what happened at the Summit of the Americas is was very symbolic, not just for Cuba and the U.S., but also for the rest of Latin America, because for years, Cuba had always been the big elephant in the room, mm-hmm. and suddenly it's gone, and mm. and it opened up it opens up the door in my mind for the rest of the Latin American countries as well to have more of an impact, or rather the U.S. to have more of an impact in the region, because again, always it was the question of Cuba and what to do with Cuba, but Cuba is the enemy. And now, without having that thing in the middle, it opens up the door to millions of possibilities. Now we can engage more freely. I mean, at least that's the hope mm-hmm. in the region, because let's face it, I mean, and I'm sure you'll agree that Cuba, you know, is a country that Latin Americans really react to. They yes. love it. They really, you know, it's not a romanticism of communism, but people feel very strongly about what happens to Cuba. And it always felt like, you know, why is the U.S., why does it see it as an enemy? And so without that in the way, I think
they
it opens up.
They don't understand the history of it, though?
No, they do. But it's more like, you know, a question of solidarity, you know? And so it was always used, I in my mind, as an excuse not to really talk about the real problems in the region in terms of U.S. policy. So now I think the U.S. has a real opportunity to have more of an impact in the region and engage Brazil and in Venezuela, what's happening in Venezuela. So, you know, I hope that happens. That's the hope, at least.
We'll touch on it, because it's so complicated.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Mentioned Venezuela, but I know, Peniel, you want to jump in.
Yeah,
on
in terms of, very quickly, in terms of the black community in Cuba, especially the last 50, 55 years, very important. Away from, certainly Fidel Castro had made mistakes, but Fidel meeting with Malcolm X in mm-hmm. Harlem in 1960, Cuba represents this anti-colonial, yes. anti-white supremacy, anti-imperialist vision. Of course, it's a flawed vision. People went to jail, people were marginalized, people were killed, but they also helped anti-colonial movements in Africa, for example.
Right.
They also received Black Panthers, including Assata Shakur, who's been a refugee in Cuba. So when we think about Cuba and Fidel Castro, January 1st, 1959, and the Sierra Maestra, Stokely Carmichael was in Cuba by 67. Cuba really is this symbol against American hegemony that's powerful globally. So we can't ever forget that. So, and we remember the revolution, Castro, 59, doesn't really become socialist until 61 in the embargo because of the CIA, the Bay of Pigs. So we have to understand
that. Well, that's why I talk about the history.
The history, mm-hmm. what most Americans don't know, the history of Cuba going back to the 19th century is about American and foreign imperialism.
Yes.
It's about slavery. It's about sugar. It's about stealing national resources from the Cuban people. But then within Cuba, there's a racial hierarchy as well. Mm-hmm. So within Cuba, there was their own system of Jim Crow. Fidel thought they had cured that.
Right.
They didn't. And so there's Black Cubanos who've experienced racism. There used to be segregated beaches in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And our relationship, civil rights, Black power, is very deep going back to the 60s. Robert F. Williams, the NAACP activist, fled to Cuba and received asylum in Cuba. Eldridge Cleaver fled to Cuba. Assata Shakur is still in Cuba. So we have to remember, Cuba represents basically a thumb in the nose at the idea that America could do whatever it wanted to do globally. And the fact that this is now over, or a part of it is over, is extremely important.
Well, let's talk about the fact that there'll be a resumption of relations formally with the United States and Cuba. And Devin, you know, not everybody's happy about this. And let's talk about, for our viewers at home, let's express and explain the criticism behind this.
I mean, I think some of the criticism behind this comes because of the 1959 and sort of this fundamental break. You know, when Fidel Castro comes to power, not everyone in Cuba is happy with what they do. So they embark on these social reforms. They start sort of saying that they want to have sovereignty. They start becoming a symbol, I think, as Peniel has described, for all the things in Latin America as well as for African Americans. And there's certain Cubans who weren't, that didn't work for them, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of them end up leaving and coming into the United States. And what happens is the United States welcomes them with open arms. You have the Cuban Refugee Act, you have the Cuban Freedom Tower. So many Cuban Americans, and the majority of them who leave in the early 60s are white, middle and upper class. Mm-hmm. They're going to be professionals. They come to the U.S., but they also didn't know that this is what was going to happen. They came to the U.S. thinking they were going to be here temporarily, mm-hmm. right? We'll be here, the U.S. will come, they'll kick out Castro and the revolutionaries, and we'll go back, and it'll be like a three-month holiday or something. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. The revolution continues, exile continues, mm-hmm. and then as the exiles gain more power and prestige in Miami politics, that starts being one of the main domestic reasons that U.S. Yes. politicians and leaders have had such a tough time.
And you have to understand the exile community, and not to belittle what they've experienced, because I have tons of friends in Miami.
Exactly.
Who have, you know,
deep stories
of
that are valid.
Family loss. Yeah. They're valid. You know, this speaks to Latin America in general. Latin American history is a history of extremes. So remember, the Bautista mm-hmm. regime was a puppet government. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say, like, explain Cuba, Godfather Part Two. Remember that scene in Godfather? You know, when you see the American money influence in Cuba, and I'm from Puerto Rico, where, it, you know, Cuba and Puerto Rico are the same wing, as mm-hmm. they say, same bird's wing. But those stories of the exile community, you kind of have to understand that as well in this. And by saying it's a story of extremes, you know, the Bautista regime led to another government, another regime by the Castro regime. And Latin America has always been about reacting against something else, mm-hmm. right? So so you see Bautista, and then you see Castro, and now we're winning. So you lose. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, you're going to lose your property. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose your family. So those stories are real. Now, at the same time, that influence of desire to come back has led to a very closed-minded, a very reactive policy that is still grounded in a Cold War. Like, we lost that in the 60s. And the third and fourth generation Cuban-American that comes from Miami is realizing that that's not my world anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's a challenge for the exile community to see some of that political clout that they got, and especially in the Latino community, because in the Latino community, Cubans are seen, well, you know, the wet foot, dry land. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're a citizen.
Right. Here, yes.
Yeah,
right.
So,
here,
so,
it's a very
so
interesting that, dynamic.
It's a very, and it gets really intense. Marcella. When you talk about Cuba, you know, Marcella, I'm looking at you. When you talk Cuba with your friends, it's like,
yes, and it's extremes completely, which, you know, makes me wonder about 2016 in the presidential race.
I was going to say that. Marco Rubio?
Correct. And so for the first time, we have two Hispanics running for president who happen to be Cuban Americans.
Right.
So it will be very interesting to see what happens. You know, if a Republican gets to the White House, what's going to happen to this policy? And Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush also, who is, you know, presumably running for president, what's going to happen to this? They're both really against this policy of new openness to Cuba. So it'll be very interesting. It'll be very interesting to watch the Cuban or the Latino vote in Florida, because as we know, you know, the Florida really determines mm-hmm. the election. But the Latino vote is it's changing, and it's not just generational in Cuba, but it's also country of origin. There's a lot of Puerto Ricans there.
Taking over Central Florida.
Yes, Puerto Rico, you know, and Venezuelans too. So it'll be very, very interesting, and it'll tell you a lot about, you know, the new dynamic over there.
Well, for the folks who are watching right now who are not up to speed as far as understanding why, people who just don't have the background on Ted Cruz or Marco
right.
Rubio, and they're saying, well, listen, doesn't this make sense for you? Why wouldn't you want Cuba and the United States to resume and come into the 2015 and move forward? Why are they
well,
so against it?
Marco Rubio, I mean, he's very young, but he's tied to that other experience. His parents, you know,
right.
were Cubans, and so he has that deep connection to that generation of Cubans that, you know, fled the island, and so he still has a very personal, you know, reaction to
because you would think he'd be part of the new generation.
Yeah, but
no,
but
he's kind of our generation in the like.
Yeah, totally.
You're close to that. Like the I'm talking younger generation of
right, right. Yeah, the younger, like, you know, maybe second or third generation
like
of Cuban.
Like,
yeah, but his parents, you know, they're very, very hardcore, you know, anti-Castro. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, he'll definitely play that card of being, you know, to the Cuban exile community and being completely against this new policy. And again, you would think, I mean, he's what, in his early 40s?
He's 43. Mm-hmm.
He's 43. Yeah. I mean, he's young, but he's certainly the youngest of all the candidates. But you know, who knows? I hope that, you know, perhaps he'll change his mind. I just doubt it.
He's not going
to
change.
One thing we should say about the Castro and the Cuban exile community is that they're very conservative. They were capitalists who exploited the Cuban people for decades.
True.
And this is just
mm-hmm.
empirical evidence, right? And they found a home among Reagan's neoliberal neoconservative, right-wing, absolutely racist America. That's the Cuban exile community, okay?
Or the first wave.
The first wave, right?
Right.
And so some of their kids have been infected with that same disease of racism. Some of their kids have not been, right? So when you think about Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, even though they're 43 and maybe 42 years old, they skew to the right wing of that Cuban exile community. So even as they're in their early 40s, what they're articulating is the same rhetoric of maybe an upper middle class, white-skinned Cubano who comes to the United States in 1960, 61, who's lost their businesses. And we should say Fidel Castro nationalized business in Cuba. He did what Nelson Mandela did not, which is why Nelson Mandela gets the Nobel Prize and Castro did not. Because what nationalization means, everything that Americans or outside investors had put into Cuba, you say it's ours.
Right.
That's what you do. You announce on day one. Guess what? Many people are upset
Thank you for your contribution. Okay, let's turn back to the local conversation. What have you been hearing in Massachusetts as far as when the announcement or saw that it was going this way, middle of December? Cuba is obviously the topic, hot topic. What did you hear on the streets locally regarding this?
First of all, it depends, because from the Boston community, because of JFK, right, the legacy of JFK,
right,
the missile crisis, Cuba's always sort of been ingrained around here because of the president. So I think there was a lot of people that thought it made sense. You know, I think people are applauding President Obama for being bold. Although in the community of where I am, in the Puerto Rican community,
right,
we're kind of like, okay, Cuba's great, but they've kind of dominated the national conversation. And what about this colony that you've had for close to, like, you know, 117 years? And we're U.S. American citizens, and we kind of have a similar history to Cuba. And guess what? There was a revolution in 1950 that no one knows about because the United States squashed it in, like, a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, they bombed two towns in Puerto Rico. And there's a great book now called War Against All Puerto Ricans that talks about this nationalist revolution that never happened.
So it's what about us?
Yeah, what about us? So there's a lot of Puerto Ricans going, that's great, President Obama, but like, pay attention to us now. So that's kind of what I'm hearing, because obviously it's my, you know, all the Boricuas in Boston.
That's your world, yeah. Back in December 17, when we first hear this was happening, I remember I was actually working on a piece about Alan Gross, the American contractor who had been imprisoned in Cuba for almost 5 years. And then we hear that he was freed, and then we hear about this new, you know, this joint announcement. And so I remember I was getting ready to go to work, and instead of going to work, I drove to El Oriental de Cuba, which is the, you know, this JP. Great Cuban restaurant in Jamaica Plain, where all this community of Cuban exiles gather every day. And so I wanted to go see what the reaction was. And so the owner, I remember running into him when I was there, and he's like, I don't want to talk. This is very, you know, very raw, very emotional. And then finally he later told me, you know, not until, and this, you know, again, this is the raw emotion coming out of him. He was like, not until Fidel Castro dies, you know, this will really be over. But then I heard about, you know, from other people being completely optimistic about this and what it means. But then again, you would have this old guard of Cuban exiles who still react very strongly, you know, against Castro and what that meant. So, again, very polarizing reactions, what I saw, you know, back then. And, you know, now at the Summit of the Americas, it was very symbolic. But now we're really starting, or we are going to start to see what this means, you know, with, you know, finally Cuba being removed from, you know, the state that sponsored terrorism list, which made no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so that is going to mean a lot of new opportunities for Cuba in terms of, you know, they're now gonna, because that's a really big deal.
Of course.
Being on the terrorism list has real implications. Now they're gonna have access, presumably, you know, to the international financial and capital markets, and there's gonna be more opportunity for economic development. So that's when really we're gonna start to see the impact soon, hopefully.
Well, you know, Peniel, when you were talking earlier, you talked about race
in Cuba. And we have to explore that here on Basic Black. That's a topic that we usually delve into regarding the United States and its challenges with race historically. But the Latino community obviously has dealt with that. And in Cuba, you think about, I mean, you look the people and they look like all of us here. It's honestly on this panel, we could all blend in right there because
we could all be Cubans.
Yeah, we could. But Devin, Pinil, we'll go with you. You put the foundation there, but Devin, what do you think about that? You've been there many times. Talk about the caste system almost, or the racial system and the issues that go on in Cuba.
Well, so let me do two things, because one, I'll talk about that for sure, but I do want to add about how Cubans responded to that December 17th event, because we were talking a little bit about the response here. I immediately emailed everybody I knew on the island, and I'm like, so, did you guys hear it? They're like, we were watching it. It was great. It was so exciting. And there was a lot of enthusiasm and optimism, right? Everybody saying, we don't know what's going to happen. This is great. Maybe they'll get rid of the embargo next. Mm. So you really felt Cubans being like, okay, this is a chance. This is a really change in policy. Mm-hmm. And then a couple weeks go by, and people are like, well, wait a minute. Are they getting rid of the embargo? Mm. Are they going to change the state-sponsored terrorist listing? So there became this like, well, maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's just symbolic. Mm-hmm. And so I think actually Obama's announcement recently that they're going to remove them from the terrorist list is actually something that finally there's something tangible, mm-hmm. right? Okay. You know, just saying that we're going to talk. Cubans are like, okay, great. And then they're like, no, wait. How is this going to affect my real life?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so now the changing in the terrorist listing is actually going to be able to mean that they won't be on that list. They'll have other business opportunities nationally. That'll mean that real life will change. I'll shift to your second question. So I just wanted to say that. That was important, right? But then the second question is about race in Cuba, and this is really complicated. All of my research has been about race in Cuba in the 1960s. And so one of the things is I agree with Pinel about the fact that we have this state-sponsored anti-discrimination campaign that started in March of 1959. It's all over the headlines. Mm-hmm. When no one else is talking about getting rid of discrimination, the Cuban revolutionary leaders, who are predominantly white, are saying, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. This is the main goal of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And it becomes something that has real effect on people's lives. By the 1980s, you have the same amount of Cuban doctors, professionals, high school education rates. Afro-Cubans and whites are pretty much equal in all these sort of standard markers of equality, compared to the US and Brazil, where you don't see that. Mm-hmm. And then the 1990s happen, right? Mm-hmm. The economic crash after the fall of the Soviet Union, and Cuba's economy comes to a standstill. Mm-hmm. And what do they have to do? They have to figure out how they're going to change. And one of the ways they do that is by opening up to foreign investment. Mm-hmm. And when you start opening up to foreign investment and capitalism, Afro-Cubans were looking for ways to make money, and they didn't have the same resources as other people. They couldn't get remittances from white Cubans. They didn't have any family members to send them money. Mm-hmm. And they also couldn't get jobs in the hotel and the tourist industry, where they had preference for Buena Presencia, right? Light-skinned Cubans.
Right.
So with all of this happen, everyone starts talking about the return of racism. And that's the caste system that you're talking about now, is where, like, now everyone's like, racism has returned, and I'm always asking, well, where do you think it went? Right? Right?
I think it's always been there in Latin America, and that's the darkest, you know, the ugliest secret, is that it's based on 500, we're talking five centuries of a caste system, and one of the things that people, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but there was these caste system, like there's a caste system classification of like of that. It's crazy.
I want you to expound on it. So I just want to let people at home know that this conversation is far from over. We have about a couple minutes left in the broadcast. Then we're going to take this conversation online, continue it here on Basic Black. So stay with us through the TV broadcast and then go online. So please talk about this caste system.
So basically what you see is like probably about 30 squares.
Yeah.
And, you know, goes from light to really, you know, really dark skin. Mm-hmm. And you start, everything gets labeled. So it's like if you're an African slave and you marry a criollo, which is a Spaniard that was born in Latin America, you come out with a, you know, a mulatto or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about race has always been ingrained in Latin America. So when that, you know, when you say about, you know, Afro-Cubans that didn't get that access because it's now tourism, and you have, you know, the Europeans are coming.
Right.
And it's like, I don't want, you know, we need to have lighter skinned people. So that, even the best of intentions, it's still in sort of that cultural psyche of like, white will always be better in Latin America. Yeah. And that, if you look at Latin America in general, it's very, that is still there. That caste system is still there in politics.
Oh, totally.
In socioeconomic. Yeah. And it's just starting to get discussed openly
Just starting. 500 years,
mm-hmm. and we're just starting to talk about it. Like, that's
Mexico has one of the worst records at being racist, and it's really shameful. Yeah. But to your point, it's just starting, and that is amazing to think about.
Cuba, even during the '60s, when they were trying to do what Devin is saying, and they had they would always bring Comandante Juan Almeida, who was Afro-Cuban, very visibly. But if you read memoirs and if you talk to the Cuban people, even during the '60s, during this Reformation, they'll say there were less Afro-Cubans in high government and military positions within the CP, within the Cuban Communist Party. And after a while, no one wanted to hear that. So the interesting part is, even as what Devin is saying is absolutely right in terms of empirically by the '80s, the doctors and different stuff, the high level was never integrated in the way that they claimed it was, to the point where, you know, visitors who would come in the '60s and '70s, you were verboten from even deviating from the line. If you asked, like, where are all the Afro-Cubans in the most highest positions, they told you to just, look, we're doing our jobs, and you've got the race problem in America. So it's a very interesting denial in Cuba, even as Cuba is sort of like the best example in a way of trying to have some kind of racial integration, unlike, say, Argentina. Chile under Allende, would that have happened? But that's very short-lived. Mm-hmm. One thing we haven't talked about is Fidel's massive influence on that hemisphere. Because you think about Fidel and Venezuela, Fidel and Chile.
To continue the conversation, see past episodes, or discover new stories, please visit our website at basicblack.org. We'll be right back.